and now.
Welcome back to Your Artificial Friends. I'm Andy Chanley. Sam Farmer is with me, as well as Larry Morgan. Josh Fligger is on assignment.
He's always on assignment. I can't wait to see what he comes up with.
But if you knew what his assignment was, you wouldn't be jealous.
That's usually normally I use that when it's a euphemism for somebody who's supposed to be there is out having plastic surgery.
No, he's putting a radio station down. Euthanizing a radio signal.
It's taken a long time.
It takes
time.
A lot.
Is he choking it out?
I feel so sorry for him because he's got all the, he's the one, if you email the station about programming, if you email the station, he gets it.
He
has to.
Does he have to answer every one?
Every single one of them he has to answer.
Oh, God. I'm going to email him right now. While we're doing this podcast, I'm just going to send a 1,000 emails with terrible things.
Do you get when you get these emails, people don't think there's somebody on the other end that they're talking to. So you get some of the
totally
rudest. Most vulgar, crude emails, and you respond. If you respond with a pleasant response, it usually catches them off guard.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
And it's also the most difficult thing to do is be polite when they're being jerks.
Well, that's the thing is that when you kill them with kindness sometimes, that's how you get back at them.
Disarm them.
But he gets all of these, and I can just hear him in his office. He opens one and it's like, "Hey, you people!" And he's like, "Okay, I'm out. I'm done." By all means, the address, what is it? heysound@thesoundla.com. You have precious little time to send him an email that annoys him.
So please do it.
Please get on that.
And make sure in the subject line it always says, "Hey, you people."
Right. Hey, right. What do you think? It's great fun for him to go through.
I remember one of our columnists, longtime columnists at the Times, T.J. Simers, got a letter said, "I've been a newspaper man for 40 years, and you are no columnist. You're no Jim Murray." You know, really ripped into him, and he wrote back, "Dear Red Smith, make sure my paper lands on the doorstep tomorrow morning."
Man, T.J. Simers, people just really ripped it. But he rubbed people the wrong way on purpose. He was one of those guys.
He was
like
a provocateur
in the Weekly World News.
He did. I will say, when he got into a story, he wrote some really good stories.
Yeah.
He was a very good reporter and but he stood nose to nose with people, and this probably segues into what we're talking about.
Yeah, we're going to talk about your worst interviews today. It's funny, though, one last thing on that. What I found is when someone writes something crappy about me, like, "You tell Andy Chanley that he doesn't know what," they'll just, go up one side and down the other, or they'll leave a phone message on the general phone box, the voicemail, and I'll respond to them every now and then, just when it's the worst. For the most part, I just let it go. But when it's someone who's really going off on a tangent, I'll pick up the phone and call them back and say, "Hey, this is Andy. Just wanted you to know, got your message. Really appreciate you caring so much about the sound that you want to call and tell us what you think." And honest, every single time you'll get some, "Hey, man, really appreciate hearing you. It'd be great to get a beer with you sometime and talk about," when they were just shitty as can be a second ago. Now they want to be my best buddy.
But
you're right. They don't consider that there's a real person on the
other
end.
They think they're writing into the ether.
That's because most of the time when you write to customer service or leave a message or something, you never get a response. So 90% of the time, I don't think most companies bother to do that. So when you do, it really does have an impact because they feel like they're anonymous. It's kind of like tweeting at somebody and never expecting to get anything back.
Oh,
and early in our careers, we all got letters. We didn't get emails, so people had to go to that, take that extra step of mailing a letter. Oh. And so you didn't get nearly as much. Now you can just type it out. But now the letters you get are either, an 80-year-old guy, which is great, or you get the cutout magazine letters. We know where you live.
I think this is a future episode of this.
Right. This might be this episode when you hear. Yeah, you're gonna love some of this stuff. You're gonna love some of this. We want to talk about your. We talked about your greatest interviews, our greatest interviews, a few episodes back, and after we after we get done with that, and we're walking to our cars, and Sam says, "Isn't it amazing what we've been able to do in our careers? You know, from starting knowing nothing to rising to, you know, to where we are now, and the access that we have to all of these people, when really we're just a bunch of what?"
Slappies. Did I say slapdicks?
he's a slapdicks, and I hadn't heard anyone use that term in years. And
slappies
almost...
was for my mom. Because I know you're listening, Mom.
So it is amazing the people that we've gotten to talk to. And what I said at the time is true, and you agree with this, and I think maybe we mentioned this last week or week before, but with you, Sam, you are a columnist. So you'll go and you'll interview these people, and they feel like they need to impress you with their life story or their charisma, so that you'll come away feeling like, oh, that's a nice person, and I'm, you know, and you get a vibe for them. Not that you would be biased by that. I think you're impartial. But if you come away with a bad vibe from someone, at least they're conscious that I don't want to make a bad impression on you. When we do radio interviews, people will come in and do whatever they want on the air, and they'll say what they want on the air. But sometimes they walk in and there is a stone wall in front of them. They don't want anything to do with you. They're angry they have to be there. They feel like they're slumming it, you know, talking to you, and you're a waste of their time, and they can't wait to get onto their lunch or whatever, and are dismissive.
It is some obligation that they have grudgingly agreed to. Mm.
And I didn't want to poop on it last time when you were talking about this, but you brought up Graham Nash.
Yeah.
I had two interviews with Graham Nash. One where he was darling. He was fantastic. Yeah. It was great. He was at his home in Hawaii. I was talking to him on the phone, and he was warm and cordial. The other time he came in to the studio, it was the day Prince died. So that's up on the TV.
Oh, yeah.
And he's gone through a nasty divorce.
Right.
And they were early, so he had to wait for a few songs until I, you know, to the break in programming where I could do it. And he was none too happy about that. He was pretty angry to be there.
Yeah.
And so it really sometimes depends on the day. It depends on circumstances. It depends on, you know, situation and different things. But sometimes, you know, you can have a great interview with someone, and sometimes you can have a bad interview with someone. One that came to my mind was... or one that I wish I could have back, I guess. It was actually a really good interview. I won't say the name of this one. A female artist.
No?
A well-known female artist.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's just not important.
All right. Well, we'll be guessing the whole time.
But by all means, please.
All right.
Who
Chrissy Hynde.
Came in to...
Sorry, I'll stop.
She just... And I'm quoting her. She was the one saying these words. I'm not assigning these to a woman. She just apologized the other day for walking off stage somewhere when people were using their cell phones. She goes, "I'm really sorry. I'm a bitch all the time. I just, you know, I don't like that kind of attention. I don't like people, you know." She goes, "I feel bad about it later at night, you know, when I'm going to bed. But I wish I could change. But you know, I won't." I love how she's apologetic
exactly.
about it. But no, I'm interviewing this female artist. And she was all the rage at the time. And the album that she had done was about failed relationships and about, you know, ships passing in the night and how, you know, things never quite worked out. And I interviewed her and I said, and I'm young at this point, you know, I'm in my 20s. And I say, so, you know, all of these stories about, you know, failed relationships or pining for the right relationship. Who is the right guy? You know, who is who would make the perfect partner for you? And I phrased that question, and maybe I rephrase it again. And she kind of, you know, hedges it a little bit and evades it. And later I come to realize that she was lesbian. So I was maybe phrasing the question in a way that wasn't comfortable for her. And I realize that now, and we've come a long way, man, in the last 20 years with being respectful of other people's preferences and lifestyle and just being a little bit more sensitive about the way we phrase things. And I wasn't trying to be a dick, but I kind of came off as one. But at least I felt like it, and it really shut down the interview. It was as if through cold water.
That was a rally killer.
Yeah, it was done. So I wish I could have had that back. And another one that I felt bad about was Warren Zevon, because he was a lovely person and a very interesting person. A big fan of his music, and he was in doing songs. And I'm asking him about his demons, and I said, all these songs you write are so dark. Are you a dark person inside, do you think? Would you call yourself that? And he said, no. The way I see it, I write these songs, and after that, they're your problem. So there you go. Dug up her grave and built a cage with her bones. That image is now yours to deal with. It'll keep you awake at night.
Yeah, if you're listening to any Warren Zevon music, you kind of have to have a feeling that he's not going to be the easiest interview in the world.
Yeah.
And maybe David Letterman's the only person that has ever gotten him to be.
But he was great, though, and he was very forthcoming. And at one point, I asked him, the follow-up question, I think, is, so, I know you battled alcoholism in the 70s that it was a dark time because of that, and he talks freely about it, but then he starts into a song. He's playing songs as close to me as you guys are, and starts into a song and stops it after the intro and goes, battled alcoholism. And it starts into the song again, and I'm like, oh, God. I really do admire, but I was just, asking a probing question, I thought. And after the song was done, he said something, and I said, I hope I didn't, put you off. He goes, oh, no, I just forgot the first lyric, so I was vamping there for a second. I was giving you a hard time. I'm like, oh, my God. But he was just the nicest guy, but I wish that I would have maybe... I didn't need to ask that question it's common knowledge, to people who care about him.
Yeah.
And by the way, the Letterman thing, I said, where are you off to next? He said, I'm flying to New York to do Letterman tomorrow. And that was a Thursday, I think. The next day would have been Friday. Later that day, David Letterman goes in for quintuple bypass surgery.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So he, didn't ever show up on Letterman that time. But, of course, he got sick, Warren Zevon did, lung cancer. And I think he was sick then, and he knew it, because the album that he was promoting was called Life Will Kill Ya.
Yeah.
And, there's a song on there called Don't Let Us Get Sick.
Yeah.
It's a real self-examination, that album, and I think one of his best. And I think he kind of knew that something wasn't quite right at that point.
I think it was a protracted thing, actually. It's interviews like that, and maybe, Sam, you've experienced the same thing, is you're right. Those guys, knowing the kind of tenor of the interview, the kind of person they are, is a little intimidating, and they just they tend not to suffer fools. So I always take that as a little bit of a challenge, though, because I like to find that opening to get those people to open up a little bit.
Right.
And
like you did with Graham Nash, was showing him something that he was not expecting. It was
a question or a line of questioning that's not typical. I do a lot of those. I have done a lot of those movie junkets. I get asked to fill in for a guy who works up in Sacramento who comes down to LA all the time. Mm-hmm. And those, you don't have to feel sorry for rich movie stars, but that is one circumstance where I would not trade places with them to have to sit there and talk to the frickin' idiots that do entertainment segments in Cincinnati and Kansas City and come in, hey, I got 5 minutes and I'm going to get something great from you.
Right.
And I always enjoy going into those and finding a way to because usually you're about 12 or 15 or 20 or 30 reporters deep when you get in there, and they've just had it. They're and especially people like Tina Fey is somebody who I admire, who I think is really brilliant and naturally funny. But she also strikes me as somebody who just doesn't like to put up with bullshit. Yeah. And I walked in, she did a movie with Paul Rudd that was not very good. I think it was called something. It was about college admissions. I can't even remember it.
I remember that vaguely.
Vaguely, yeah.
And HBO. She clearly was getting close to done, and I could see it in her eyes. And it's like, oh crap! I really don't want her. And it was one of those where I had to be super careful about what I was going to throw at her and not just the typical thing. And I think the first thing I did is complimented 30 Rock, which was going into its like final season right then. Congratulations, something like that. And so that made it easier. But, you know, when you find those people and you can turn them, by the end, they're like, oh.
I was doing the show Dark Blue. I think it was on USA or somewhere. It was this cop show like eight, nine years ago. And I go in one of those junkets, and Dylan McDermott was the lead on it. Yeah. I sit down, and my first question is, so how often do you get confused for Dermot Mulroney? He starts laughing. He's like, God, all the time. As a matter of fact, our kids go to the same school. I've been sent home Dermot Mulroney's kids' homework so many times.
Oh, that's a classic.
It's not even funny anymore.
That's right.
So he actually did. Dermot Mulroney, Dylan McDermott.
I sat down in a TV junket in New York, a movie junket in New York, with the actors of 12 Years a Slave.
That must have been a knee slapper.
And my buddy Mark Allen sent me to that because he was like, I have no idea how to approach these people on that. Because that's a freaking heavy movie.
Yeah.
But I just didn't. And knowing the nature of the show that this stuff was going to be on, I was looking for any opportunity to lighten things up. And Fassbender, Michael Fassbender, seems like a very serious guy, and he really is. And he also had a role in that's pretty tricky stuff, that he was an incredibly unlikable character that movie.
He was a slave owner.
He was the plantation owner and the one that was abusive.
Pretty much evil incarnate.
Oh, yeah. Just the worst. So trying to find an end to talk about that character, and he's really very into his process too, and more than happy to talk about it. And was just giving me these incredible, thoughtful answers to these questions, which I felt like I had to approach.
Yeah.
And then finally, I get around to, okay, can I lighten things up a little bit? And he goes, yes, please. He's like, oh, good. All right, so there's your little opening.
Right.
I said, so I'm looking at you and Chiwetel Ejiofor and, you know, and I list off these other names. And I go, is it true that all good American male roles are being taken over by actors from the UK? And he paused and he said, yes, you're on to me.
Yep.
I said, really? And I said, yes. We're a club. We meet. Like, oh, wow, I'm cracking this wide open. He goes, no, I have to kill you now. But he stayed at that level the whole time. It was like, oh, how nice to get a little kind of dry humor. And he played with me a little bit. And he seemed really appreciative that he got to get away from the darkness for a little bit.
Yeah.
I was going to say,
Mr. Chandler.
Speaking of
you
darkness,
have the floor.
Speaking of darkness, Sam, tell us about the time that you were almost killed by a serial murderer.
Well, okay,
the perfect segue. See, I was happy to hear that Michael Fassbender wanted to kill me. That would be the best obit of all time.
I had a good White House story queued up and a good Tim Tebow story queued up,
but I'll write this down.
We'll have to write those down for another episode. Another episode. This was a lot of the crazy things that happened to me early in my career happened when I was covering the Oakland Raiders, not surprisingly, which was a wild group and locker room and everything that implies. I remember early on, this was probably 1995 or 96 maybe. No, it was a 97. Anyway. 96, 97, sometime around then. The Raiders had a defensive end named Anthony Smith. And Anthony was a very good player, had played at, I think, Auburn and then transferred to the University of Arizona, was a first-round pick of the Raiders. Big, tall, good-looking, like sculpted guy.
Defensive ends are mountains of men.
Yeah, and some of those guys are big and sort of shapeless. This guy was a huge, you know, just cut guy.
Sculpted.
Yeah, and so he was married to Vanity, one of Prince's dancers.
She
had come to his door, was proselytizing around the neighborhood. She had, I think, dealt
with
drugs.
Make sure you say that word carefully. Yes. She was proselytizing.
She was proselytizing.
For Jesus,
door to door. And apparently she came to his door, she came in, she never left. They got married, and ultimately I think their relationship broke up amid accusations of abuse and that kind of stuff. But, so Anthony Smith could be a scary guy. He had walked off the team. They played the Bears, and he left the team on the tarmac and essentially quit the team briefly. Sort of mercurial.
Volatile
guy. I had his phone number, so I called him when he was had briefly quit the team, if I recall correctly. And I was exchanging messages with him, and we agreed that, hey, we're going to grab lunch. We're going to grab lunch and talk about this. That was a scoop for me to be able to get. There were several papers that covered the Raiders, and I was going to get the first interview with them. Well, that never materialized, and he came back to the team. And the next week with the team, he is now turned on me. I go in the locker room, and he's like, don't trust this guy. And he's and so I'm kind of laugh, you know, and it's a crowded locker room, and I laugh. He says, no, don't trust this guy. He said, this guy's going to – he'll watch you getting dressed. And I was like, what are you talking about? This is like you know, it's bizarre.
Yeah.
It's bizarre behavior, and I'm not even going to – it doesn't even merit a response.
Sure.
I'm going to walk away. And so he's shouting this stuff, and but he's a big, scary guy, you know. He's like, so whatever. I do my work. I finish up my interviews, and locker room session closes. And but now, definitely, I've, you know, underlined his name. I'm not going to deal with this guy because he's an idiot. Later that afternoon, I'm walking past the locker room, and the door pops open, and it's Anthony Smith, and he says, Sam, come here. And I said, I'm not coming there. What are you talking about? He said, no, come in the locker room. And I said, I'm definitely not coming in the locker room. I don't know what's going on. And then another player, Albert Lewis, pokes his head out, and he said, no, Sam, come in. So I really liked Albert, and I like most of the guys on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in there, and the whole team was sitting there quiet at their lockers, all of them. It was surreal. I mean, in my mind's eye, thinking back, it's almost like a dream. And I'm standing in front of the whole Raiders team, and Anthony Smith said, I just want to apologize the way I treated this guy. Sam, I was really a jerk, and I don't know why. And I was like, okay, yeah, thanks, carry on, you know, and I left. And I thought, did that really happen? Did that just happen? That is really bizarre.
And they were all sitting there dutiful.
Yes.
Like,
paying attention.
Like he,
exactly.
Like he had influence on them as a leader, or he had influence on them as a fear.
I don't think that he had influence on them. I think they had influence on him. I think guys like Terry McDaniel and Albert Lewis and Jeff Hostetler and some of the leaders of the team said
that wasn't cool.
You can't do this. That's not cool. So, so fast forward a few years, Anthony Smith's out of the league. Suddenly, he's accused of multiple murders, and hit style, like
execution.
Is it like you'd be a drug lord hitman?
Yeah,
right.
One was impersonating a police officer and making a quote unquote arrest of two workers at a car wash, and they turn up dead. So, it was, and this is in my mind's eye. He was ultimately in 2015 convicted of three murders, I believe.
Yeah.
I
checked it on Wikipedia. Yeah,
he's legit as a you know, in the arsons.
Your suspicion was founded. Well,
yes.
Founded.
Yes. So later, this is 2000, talking about uncomfortable interviews. 2000, the Raiders had drafted Sebastian Janikowski, the kicker, out of Florida State, who had a checkered career at Florida State off the field.
Right.
So much so that early in his career, there was a a provision in his contract that mentioned drinking and not going out.
Some alcohol-related shenanigans that had happened. They didn't want him
out carousing,
right,
because of his history. Very unusual to spend a first round pick on a kicker,
right,
but they did, and it turned out to be a good decision.
He's still their kicker.
Tenured Raider. Right?
He's hurt now, but their kicker all this time later.
Well, he'll be a Hall of Fame kicker.
Sure.
But I got word from a friend who has a friend who owns a bar in San Francisco that he was out at closing time. It was probably 2 a.m. I don't recall exactly. Drinking. Sebastian Janikowski as a rookie, midway through his rookie season. John Gruden is the coach. So I had to ask Sebastian Janikowski about it. Well, I didn't want to ask him in front of the group of reporters, so I waited out in the parking lot after practice. And Sebastian came out with Shane Leckler, who was his roommate. Shane Leckler was a rookie punter at the time. And so I said, Sebastian, I just want to ask you, I've heard you've been out drinking. Now, this is a tough question to ask. I'm a young guy, and this is a 250-pound kicker. And
they call him Seabass for a reason.
Yes, yes. And his eyes narrow, and he looks over to Leckler, and he shakes his head, and he says, don't ever talk to this guy. And, string of expletives so I'm just left there kind of numb standing there. Didn't get an answer. Now have alienated the first-round draft pick, which by necessity, but it still is an uncomfortable feeling. And I'm standing in the parking lot. These guys get in their big Escalade, I believe. Maybe the Escalade, big monster truck, whatever it was.
Right.
Sebastian's driving. He makes a beeline for me, squeals out, makes a beeline for me. I have to almost literally dive between two cars as the SUV fishtails out of the parking lot. It would have killed me. I mean, obviously. And he was just enraged. And it was quite harrowing. And then later in that season, I was standing on the field, and he came running right at me. And at the last second, you know, just
pulled
sort
up.
Of, no, didn't pull out. Didn't pull up. Just dodged me like you'd dodge a ski gate if you were a ski racer.
Did the get out challenge?
Maybe even with a little
yeah. beeline for you.
With
and
a little
make the right turn.
Little shoulder brush as he went past.
No, is that the flavor that you're left with him, or did you ever?
We never really made amends. I'm sure he doesn't remember it. Life has gone by. This was 17 years ago. I mean, we see each other on occasion, and it doesn't seem to, the light doesn't seem to go on in his head that, you know, he probably says, I look fatter and grayer now.
Yeah.
So he's probably thinking this poor
You were much more handsome back
yeah,
then.
Yeah. So
I think the best part of that story, Sam, is that Janikowski had any reason to think you would want to talk to the punter.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't talk to this guy. Okay. But nobody wants to talk to me.
You're narrowing my options. Yeah, but there was always, I remember one interview I was in Coral Gables, Florida at the owners meetings, and I'm in the lobby, and Al Davis comes through the lobby, and I covered the Raiders, so I knew Al. And, but I didn't get a lot of opportunities to have one-on-one conversations, probably 10 in my life, with Al. And I said, Al, can I talk to you? And he said, come up to my suite. And now he's got like, oh, you know, the full sweatsuit on, black Raider sweatsuit. And he said, I walk in to his suite, and it's a big presidential suite at the Hilton. And he's got weights set up. He's got a bench and maybe like 3 45s on each side. So a lot, you know, wow. And he's built like Mr. Burns, you know, in The Simpsons.
Right.
You know,
I was going to say, the one thing you don't think of when you think Al Davis is, dude, that dude was cut.
Yes. Well, that's funny,
like,
you'd say that because
it, 315? 315
pounds? 315
pounds.
And now it was always said that he brought weights on the road for show, you know, and had this these weights moved around, and the owners, other owners, kind of looked at it askance and rolled their eyes. But so I said, Al, I see you got your weights, and he looks at me, he says, yeah, it's hard to stay cut at my age. So he did. Hard to stay cut. He was 72 years old. So I remember being at an owner's meeting, another owner's meeting in Chicago, and I was talking to Joe Brown, who was an NFL executive. And at this point, Al had was not walking as well, and so he had sort of a Sherpa that he'd hang on to his backpack and walk by. So Al, I'm talking to Joe and writing some things down, and he's an NFL exec. And Al comes by, kind of shuffles by, and he says, Sam, they keep lying and you keep writing it. I said, wow, it was a shuffle by shooting. He got us both with one shot.
That's great. Yeah.
I hear guys, I don't know how you feel about this, Andy. I haven't interviewed that many sports figures, but I hear sports guys have to be the toughest interviews because they're not by nature performers. I mean, they're on a stage to a certain extent, and I think you are kind of lucky in that you get to do it in print and you get to kind of find your story. Whereas
right.
I hear, I mean, it's like the national guys, I hear Cowherd, you know, get great people mm-hmm. on, but then I hear like Petros and Money, who are local, they kind of get what they can get.
Yeah.
And it's a struggle, man, to get sometimes.
They get people like Petros.
Yeah, with that voice and nothing to say. Nah, he can talk. Luckily, yeah. Those guys can kind of fill in the gaps, but there are guys who just, I mean, that kind of is my response. Normally, we talked a couple of weeks ago about never meet your heroes kind of thing.
Yeah.
And one of my interviews, well, the first one that came to mind was my own mistake, which there was a period where I was filling in for Blair Garner on this country show called After Midnight.
After Midnight, sure.
And at the time, a lot of rock guys or former rock guys were kind of getting into country music. And Johnny Van Zant and Donnie Van Zant, who Donnie Van Zant had been with 38, had founded 38 Special.
Mm-hmm. Johnny Van Zant was the younger brother.
And Johnny took over as lead singer of Lynyrd Skynyrd. And they had formed a duo called Van Zant, and they were doing country music. And it was just my own goofball thing, but I kind of came out of break and welcomed them back and said, we're here with Van Zant, Donnie Van Zant, and Ronnie Van Zant are with us. And Johnny stopped me and goes, well, Ronnie's no longer with us, although he might be with us in spirit. And that, I don't know, in my sensibility, I was so, like, flustered. I mean, look, it's Ronnie, Johnny, and Donnie, so it's partly their parents' fault, okay? But for me, it, like, set the rest of the interview, like, something was off, and it might have just been me personally, but just, we were having a great time, and then we weren't, because I reminded them of their dead brother somehow.
But maybe, in a way, it was kind of a neat thing.
Disarming?
Well, yeah, and they were able to say, yes, he's with us in spirit.
Well,
I did
love that response, but it just made me feel weird. And then one of the other great, terrible music interviews was with people barely know this band, The Cardigans.
Oh, yeah.
A Swedish band.
Oh, yeah. Didn't they do
Love Fool?
Love me, tell me all
right.
Love me.
Right. Well, they were kind of making the rounds of radio stations when that song was a really big hit, and they were out of Sweden. And I was working for Star 98.7 at the time, which was in the same building, different company as K-Rock in Burbank back in the day. And they went to Kevin and Bean first, and then they were going to come down and talk to us.
And slum it with you.
Yes, exactly. We always got, at least we got second because we were in the same building. And we knew nothing from the Cardigans. I mean, who knew anything about the frickin' Cardigans? And we spent all morning going, what are we going to ask the Cardigans?
Say, so, hooty, hooty, hooty.
Right. So we're tuning in, Kevin and Bean, and listening to their interview to get some ideas. Right. And the interview is awful. It is awful. And to this day, they will run clips and mention that as being the worst interview they ever had.
Just excruciating.
And they're literally saying this on the air. It's like Bean, who doesn't have much of a filter, I think is actually saying, this may be the worst interview we've ever done. And we're sitting there going, oh, shit, we have to talk to them next. Oh, wow. And it went exactly the same way. It was one-word answers in a bad accent, and they were tired, and they were hungover, probably, mm-hmm. and they didn't want to be there.
Drinking
and
all that ice wine.
You'd expect more from the Cardigans.
Yeah, that's right. Really, you have such high expectations for the Cardigans.
Yeah. The cable knits, not so much, but the car. hey, you just reminded me of something with your mention of Matt Moneysmith and
Petros Papadakis.
Of radio interviews. Well, no, I was just looking through Twitter the other day, and someone had asked him, it was a comment like, about OMC. Remember the band?
The How Bizarre.
How Bizarre. Yeah. How Bizarre. Yeah. How Bizarre. Yeah. And somebody asked him a question, and somehow I was copied in it. I was tagged in it. They said, maybe Andy Chanley knows about that. And I've never met Matt Moneysmith. I'm sure he's a wonderful person. Yeah, nice Seems guy. Like a great guy. But he, you know, I said, yeah, I do have a story about them, but it's not what you think. I'll have to tell it sometime. Well, I should tell it now because it is, honest to God, it left my mind until just now. This is my quintessential bad interview story. Because I like to do what you were talking about, where you, and what you do, Sam, where you, you know, well, you do. You put more effort into it. You'll actually go to people's hometowns and talk to people, and then
and
you know,
research.
Go,
and know what you're talking about.
Like you said, concentrically towards the object of the main interview.
Yeah.
But Larry and I will ask, just try to ask questions that catch people off guard a little bit, or just aren't the garden variety questions they're used to getting. So I've done that a lot over the years. Like I remember. The Sound, we had a train come by back at the early days when it was a AAA station, and Pat Monahan's there and other guy from the band, and they come in, and I had interviewed him years before at Channel 103.1. We're on video and we're filming it, and I say, hey, it's Andy Chanley from 100.3 The Sound. I'm here with members of Train. Pat Monahan, good to see you again. It's been years since we've talked. Tell me everything that's happened in your life between now and then. And it just caught him off. He's like, he started laughing, and it was such a great, off your balance question a wonderful environment for the rest of the interview was christened, and this was gonna be great.
Right,
and then Sam, who's operating the camera, says, oh, wait, I'm sorry, I've got to stop you guys. We're out of film. Well, that one's in the toilet. Wadded that up, started over 10 minutes later, and the magic's gone.
And you can't do the same
thing. You can't ask the same question.
Hard to recreate that.
Another time, not long after that, Ben Harper and the Relentless Seven?
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think
not Ben. Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right?
I'll check it.
Anyway,
fact check.
They're in the studio, Ben Harper and the Relentless Seven.
Yes.
And I started the interview with, so tell me, why won't you relent? And somehow, after years, I was the first person to ask that question that caught them off guard, and that was fun. But years earlier, it was, I think, 97, and I'd just gotten to Indianapolis, wet behind the ears. Or gotten to Los Angeles from Indianapolis. And I'm at Y107, and How Bizarre by OMC was on the charts. And Pauly Fuamana, lead singer from that band, who's, Filipino? Or I forget what his Larry's going to look it up on
Twitter. Yeah, I am. Because I interviewed them
as
well.
His heritage is. He comes in. Is it a Maori?
I think they're from New Zealand. That's what I was thinking. Because they have all the all the tattoos and everything.
That's it. That's right. Yeah. So he comes in, and so I'm thinking, I don't know anything about this guy. This is a medley of their hit.
And they're going to say it.
I don't have anything to ask them particularly. So I get him on the microphone, and we're live, right? And I say to him, so, Pauly, tell us. Ever killed a man? Just, throwing out something ridiculous to maybe make him laugh, or we'll have a fun interview.
Well, there was a circumstance I was a part of that I'm not
very proud of now, and I've made amends, and I'm like, holy shit, what have I uncorked here? I just asked him a blind dart in the hallway, and it hit a balloon, and this is something that to this day, I don't know what he's talking about, but it was excruciating.
Andy the Jolly Joker.
People still remember that. People who were in the building at the time, like, holy shit, dude, you just took all the oxygen out of that room. it was
probably the thing that I talked about, the Never Meet Your Heroes. This is more on the phone, but it's the one in my mind where the proportion between high expectations and limited returns was when I was on the radio and George Carlin was coming through town he agreed to do a phone interview with us. He was doing a big show in Houston. This was early 90s. And I mean, George Carlin, if I can say I had comedy heroes, he was right in there. I mean, and right in my sweet spot of growing up, I had to listen. You know, when some people were listening to rock and roll in their headphones, I was listening to the dirty records from Richard
Toledo
Frye.
Window Box?
Yeah. Well, you know, AM FM and Class Clown. But then there was Occupation Fool with an E on the end. And that had the Seven Dirty Words track on it.
Right.
And I couldn't exactly crank that up in my room. So I listened to that freaking over and over. But and I stole a bunch of stuff from him. My buddy Brian Oakley and I did, you know, some of his bits in a talent show at Nimitz Junior High School. You know, it's just like,
Everybody did.
Yeah, I think about George Carlin every week when I'm driving on the freeway, whether it's the, you know, you're going the exact right speed, everybody going faster than is a maniac, everybody slower is an asshole.
The combination of one of the funniest plus smartest plus intelligent about having a point of view of something in the world. I mean, there was nobody better. So
the king of observational comedy, where you hear it and like, oh my God, he's right about that. And one would have ever thought about
Seinfeld. I mean, Seinfeld was sort of a...
Yeah, it's, you know, your stuff. Go somewhere and then you're going to go to the other side of the island. You got to get a smaller version of your stuff.
He loved words. Yeah, I mean, he crafted those bits in a way that were so meticulously... And it turns out that was his thing, was writing that material. So he gets on the phone, and I'm a huge, huge fan. I immediately start with that, and I talk about, you know, I can't tell you how many times I listened to, you know, all of them. I mean, I listed off all the records, Occupation Fool, I listened to it over and over again, and basically his response was, well, thanks, that's great. Love those records. It's like, okay, so it was like that the whole time. And you've interviewed comedians before, and it's a dicey proposition unless they really get it. And they know, I got to give you a little something, but I also want to leave enough for you to kind of go find me or come to my show or whatever it is.
That's the thing. You've got to play the kabuki game of you have to... ask questions that set them up.
Yeah.
And they'll usually provide you with that if they're good at what they do and they know how to do it. And you'll set up and you'll sit there and laugh, not try to beat them to the punchline.
Right. And not try and be funnier than them.
Not trying to be funnier than
riff.
Them. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, I didn't have the luxury of like any kind of pre-interview with George because we had limited time with him. But I know the guy's work and I know what he's like.
Right.
And I'm lobbing up softballs for him. And I talk about, I mean, it was...
Is it like Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney? Is it that good?
I was a little better prepped than that. Right. But it was right around election time. It was Clinton versus Bush. I mean, it was like there was just, it was ripe with possibilities. So I talked about, you know, political scene right now, it's really heating up. The debates are coming up. You know, what are your thoughts on that? And his answer to every one of my questions was, well, you know what? I talk about that a lot in the show, and you know, it was that kind of thing. It was, I will give you nothing. I have no jokes. I have nothing. So I go back to this. You know, I can't believe Seven Dirty Words has been since 1970, whatever, and you know, it still holds. It literally is like the list for things haven't changed.
Pretty much,
and so I thought, okay, let me get him on a rant. Even if it's not funny, he can bag on the FCC. He's like, Yeah. We haven't made much progress in that area.
It's like, oh, George, wow. Give me fucking something.
And I literally got hung up, and I was just so crestfallen. And it's, I get it. You know, he doesn't want to necessarily give up a ton of material.
Sure.
But he was going to be on stage for an hour plus the next night. He could have given me 2 minutes.
Well, and that's the thing is usually when a comedian comes in, they'll give you one or two of the things that they're probably going to talk about. And you can tell when something is from their act.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you watch any talk show, you watch, you know, Conan or Colbert or whatever, you watch it and you can tell there was a pre-interview and there's a line that or a topic that's thrown out that the comedian latches onto and says, oh, I got to tell you this story.
Yeah.
Where, it, you know, they try to make it as organic as possible, but they're giving you part of their bit, just a little sample of their bit,
right.
Not their whole, you know, hour-long Cinemax special, but they should give you something.
Yeah, it was, I ended up, I mean, the biggest disappointment is that I got to talk to this guy who I didn't lose any respect for him, but he sure didn't help me at all, and I used zero of it on the air.
Well, I mean, who the hell are you?
I have a friend who went to Alabama to do a story on Ray Perkins, the coach there at the time, and he stayed for 2 days and got nothing. So he had to extend his trip. You know, Ray Perkins just wouldn't give him anything good. It was like the George Carlin interview. And so he stayed an extra day. And recognizing this, Ray Perkins walked him across the campus. And they walked past a certain area, and Ray Perkins pointed to the ground. Now, my friend is desperate. He stayed 3 days. He's got no lead. He's got no any way to sort of write this story any differently. And Ray Perkins says, see that spot right there? He points to a spot on the ground. He said, almost died right on that spot. And I mean, the clouds part.
Right.
Says, this is fabulous. He says, well, what happened? Ray Perkins said, I lived.
The end.
That's great. Yeah, talking about with comedians and radio interviews, when I was in Indianapolis, I worked down the hall from Bob and Tom, and one of the things I realized that they did that was masterful, and I always remembered this. You said, Larry, don't try to overshadow the comedian. Let them be the funny person. There are so many people that I encountered since that time in radio who, and we all bungle it from time to time and step on people's toes and inadvertently get to the punchline, you know, and bungle things. But trying to stay out of their way, Bob and Tom got early on that if someone comes on their show and is funnier than they are, that people aren't going to go out that day and say, oh my gosh, did you hear Kevin James this morning on 94.7? No, they're going to go out that day and say, oh God, did you hear that comedian on Bob and Tom this morning?
Yeah, yeah.
They were great. They'll get the credit. Right. Because it happens in their room, and they laugh at it, and they get the credit for being in proximity.
And that's an ego thing. That is idiot morning guys who tend to want to be the star and can't allow the other person to be their equal. But that you're absolutely right. They knew if they brought somebody in, they knew it was to make them, their job was to make them shine and to laugh hysterically at what they did, which was usually genuine because they always brought in great people, and that's why comedians love that show.
Yeah.
It's an Indianapolis-based show that's only heard in the Midwest.
And Bob Kevoyan has the most infectious laugh of anyone on the planet.
And I've talked to guys who, Bob Zaney, who lives out here and still goes out there and does that. It's like he doesn't even perform here anymore, but he'll go out there and he'll do a show in one of their affiliate cities in Dayton or something.
Yeah.
And it'll freaking sell out if Bob and Tom mention it.
Yeah.
I mean, they just, and they'll sell CDs. They're still selling CDs.
Yeah, they're still making CDs.
That's sort of a maxim in sports writing or journalism or whatever. If you've got a great story, get out of its way.
Yeah.
Don't try to write it unless you're Gary Smith at Sports Illustrated and can spin a yarn like nobody. just get out of the way and people will appreciate that. Just as if you're transcribing it and just you don't need your commentary or anything to set it up.
Yeah.
And let people experience the story like you experienced it. So.
Well, we're going to get out of your way now. Yeah. That's it today for Your Artificial Friends. Please reach out to us. You can find me at Andy_Chanley@twitter.com.
I am at LA Times Farmer on Twitter.
And I am at Larry_Morgan on Twitter.
And Josh will be joining us again soon, Josh Fligger. I don't know where you find him. He's still laboring away in futility. Oh, you got to write him an email.
Oh, he's answering my
email.
HeySound@thesoundla.com.
Yeah, he's answering my 40 emails I just sent.
Make it long and convoluted and pointless if you possibly can.
And use words that he doesn't understand, like proselytizing.
Proselytizing. Yeah. And by all means, tell a friend about this podcast. It's on iTunes and audioboom.com. We're Your Artificial Friends.
All right. And OMC, please don't sue us for going out on How Bizarre.
How Bizarre. Brother Bellet's in the back, sweet singers in the front, cruising down the freeway.